And now on ABC Radio National, it's time for Counterpoint, an hour of opinion and discussion with Paul Comrie-Thompson and Michael Duffy.
Hello and welcome to the program. In a moment, we're going to look at something called the decline effect. Jonah Lehrer explains why we should be more sceptical of scientific research across a range of disciplines. And our commentator and satirist Patrick Cook returns for 2011 to offer his unique diagnosis of the body politic.
In the UK, the British government is proposing severe cuts to public spending. But John Moulton argues that this tough talk is just empty rhetoric. It will have little positive impact. And he ups the ante in this economic debate by posing this challenge. What price morality when we load up future generations with mountains of debt? Is long-term debt immoral? That's coming up later today on Counterpoint.
And also today, the issue of free speech. The important Australian website Online Opinion is facing difficult financial times. It's had advertising withdrawn after it published an article on gay marriage. We'll talk to Graham Young, the founder and chief editor of Online Opinion.
But first up, Michael, tell us about this thing called the decline effect.
One of the most interesting articles I've read in a very long time appeared in the New Yorker in December. The author is Jonah Lehrer, who joins us in a moment. Now, he's written two popular science books that have been very successful. One's called How We Decide. The other is Proust Was a Neuroscientist. The subject of the article we're talking about now is a disturbing development in a range of scientific fields, which Jonah calls the decline effect. Jonah, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with an example. You mention quite a few in your article, but let's choose the one of symmetry and sexual attractiveness, which I understand as a theory has had some problems. But can you start with the theory itself? What did it say?
This is a theory called fluctuating asymmetry, and in the early 90s, it became very popular. It was the idea, and this was seen as a crucial addition to the idea of Darwinian sexual selection, which is that males who are more symmetrical have more sex. They do better with the ladies. And people found this first in birds, but across a wide range of species.
I suspect many of our listeners will be familiar with the theory, if not with its fate. Why was it such a good theory? Was that external symmetry supposed to reflect some inner state of health?
Yeah, it was seen as one of the first examples of females actually using attractiveness as a sign of genetic fitness. The thinking being that if you're more symmetrical, you have fewer mutations and thus better genes. And so it was this idea that females had learned across this range of species, had learned to look for these markers, these physical manifestations of genetic fitness. And so that they gotten good at choosing males with better genes. And that made sense, right? That makes lots of intuitive sense, which I think in part explains why the theory was so popular.
Yeah, a huge theory, very depressing to those of us who are less symmetrical, but it had a big life. But what started to go wrong with it?
Well, what started to go wrong is the theory was first demonstrated in 1990. It was replicated a number of times. And when you look at the history of replication, so these are other scientists, completely unrelated, no affiliation, who would often go back and test the theory in other species. When you look at the history of replication and fluctuating asymmetry, it looks great for the first several years. Just about every team of scientists that tried to replicate the idea, sure enough, they found fluctuating asymmetry. But then what starts to happen after a few years, by the mid-1990s, is that scientists who go to look for fluctuating asymmetry, sometimes in new species, sometimes in the same old species, can no longer find the effect. The effect has all but disappeared. That even when it does seem to exist, it's much weaker than was previously found. So by the time you get to the late 90s, there are 12 attempts at fluctuating asymmetry per year, and just about all of them fail to find the effect. The effect has declined. It has faded over time.
And was there any suggestion that this may have been due to flaws in the original studies?
Some people certainly suggested that. Some people accused some of the first scientists, in particular a scientist named Dr. Moeller, of not being as rigorous as he should have been, perhaps even fabricating some data. None of the original papers have been retracted. And, you know, I think among many people in the field, most people in the field and including most of the people I talk to, the consensus is that this was just one of those scientific paradigms, scientific fashions that was very, very popular. And so people found what they wanted to find. They found the results that they knew would get them published. And you have to keep in mind that these are very, very difficult measurements to make, that we're often talking about, when you're talking about asymmetrical male versus asymmetrical male, you're talking about fractions of a millimeter often. Very, very small measurements of, when it comes to length of fingers or length of feathers, very difficult measurements. And it's very easy to do the measurements badly, to shade them ever just so you find what you want to find.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of the possible reasons in a second. But just for our listeners, I suppose we should now make the point that this so-called decline effect is not restricted to this example, is it? And this is really the deeper point of your article. It has been found in many other important theories.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it so troubling. It's a big issue in social psychology and psychology in general. It's a big issue when it comes to pharmaceuticals. Many, many drugs have shown this decline in efficacy over time, from second-generation antipsychotics, one of the biggest sources of revenue for drug companies right now, to even drugs like Prozac. When you compare the efficacy of Prozac, the power of Prozac in clinical trials over time, it's dramatically declined. So this is a big issue for drug companies. They are very, very concerned by the decline effect. I think what makes the decline effect so interesting to me is that it isn't just, as you mentioned, in one discipline, in one field, in the soft sciences, that it seems to appear wherever science is done.
Let's move to the possible causes now. What do you think might be some of the main reasons to explain the effect?
Well, to make a long story short, it's just human nature.
process was designed to get around that, wasn't it?
Yes, and it's astonishing how well science works. I think that's a large thing we all have to keep in mind, that science is the best process we've got for countering all the usual human biases and flaws. But scientists are still human beings, and science is very, very difficult.
Let's talk about a few of the things you mentioned in your article. One is publication bias. What's that?
So publication bias is the fact that journals, and scientists know what journals want, but the journals want a particular kind of article. So if a subject is hot, let's say you've just discovered fluctuating asymmetry, it's big news, it's written up in the newspapers, journals want, they're most interested in other articles that find fluctuating asymmetry, that show that it actually exists. They're less interested at that point in the scientific process in criticisms, in failures to replicate. Now, fast forward 5 years, fluctuating asymmetry is now an accepted idea. It's in the textbooks. Now, all of a sudden, it's more noteworthy to show that it doesn't exist. So publication bias might help explain why you get these abrupt shifts in paradigms, why all of a sudden you look at what's published in the peer-reviewed literature, you can see a theory decay very quickly. That's I think, in part because journals don't accept all articles that are proposed to them, even all rigorous articles, even all well-done articles, that in addition to having certain standards, they also know what they'd like to publish.
And as you indicated before, with the notion about symmetry, the problem can start even earlier, can't it, with the scientists themselves. You talked to a man named John Ioannidis, who I think we had on the program a year ago, who described something called significance chasing, and you yourself mentioned earlier how reporting can be almost shaped by what you're hoping to find.
Yeah, significance chasing refers to the fact that there are very consistent standards of statistical significance that are used when publishing scientific results, p-values they're called. And it's generally, you have to have a 95% certainty that the result you're describing is not an accident, not a byproduct of randomness. And so in order to get to that 95% threshold, there are all sorts of ways to kind of fudge the facts. You can throw out some, anomalies, throw out some outsiders. You can increase your sample size. You can keep on doing the experiment until you hit that threshold. And these are all examples of significance chasing. It's probably been best demonstrated in clinical trials. These drug companies obviously have huge vested interests in getting certain kinds of results. And so they tend to find ways to hit that threshold that they know they need to hit.
And so to put it crudely, you just keep doing the trial until one throws up the result you want.
That's about it. And individual scientists, of course, do the same thing. This isn't, it's important to point out this isn't fraud per se. These kinds of biases, these kinds of behaviors are often very unconscious. We're not even fully aware we're doing them or why we're doing them. But over time, you get enough flaws like this, and you tend to get some pretty misleading results.
And one of the things that makes this approach work, and I found this one of the most intriguing aspects of your article, is the presence of sheer randomness. Can you tell us about John Crabb's experiments with mice?
This to me may be the most troubling part of the article. This was an 1899 experiment where they did very standard behavioral assays on mice, you know, the stuff that are done thousands of times every day in labs all across the world. You give a mouse a smidgen of cocaine, you watch how many extra centimeters they run after the cocaine, you give them a little alcohol, you watch the effects. Just generic experiments like that. They did it for all sorts of different strains of mice in three different labs in Oregon and Albany and a lab in Edmonton. And in theory, it shouldn't have mattered where they were conducting these experiments. They tried to control everything. They all wore the exact same kind of latex gloves. They fed these mice the exact same kind of chow pellet, the exact same kind of cage. I mean, they really tried to standardize everything they could think of. And in many instances, they got very similar results in all three different labs. However, in a significant percentage of these trials, they got completely weird results where the mice in Portland, Oregon would run 5,000 more centimeters than the mice in Edmonton or Albany. that in response to alcohol, they would do something completely different too. That they would perform totally differently on certain memory tasks. So they get these completely anomalous results that have no explanation and yet were extremely statistically significant. And so what you could imagine is that these anomalous results, these total outliers, these byproducts of sheer randomness, who knows what those cocaine-addled mice were thinking that day, they would also be the easiest to get published because they look so significant and are so surprising. And so I think one of the troubling possibilities raised by this paper is that a certain percentage of scientific results, and in fact the ones most likely to get our attention, may actually just be accidents, may actually just be the byproducts of sheer randomness, of a universe we don't fully understand, where there are all sorts of variables at work that we can't even comprehend. And that may be driving a lot of these results, which get published, get lots of attention, get in the textbooks, but then can't be replicated.
Jonah, have any thoughts occurred to you while you've been working on this in terms of how we might tighten up the scientific process?
Well, you know, just in talking to researchers, I think there are many scientists, such as Jonathan Schooler. He's a psychologist at UCSB who I think has thought very intensely about this problem within his own field. And one thing he advocates is the importance of being more transparent from the start about our experiments, talking in advance about how many subjects we're going to run, about how we're going to conduct the experiment, really having to be clear about why we threw out certain results, just to do as rigorous a job as possible to eliminate significance chasing and these other biases that come into play. You know, as he points out, we have the tools to be transparent. And, you know, it really is, I think, important if science wants to get serious about eliminating these failures of replication and the decline effect, to be as transparent as possible.
Mm. For the moment, though, we have a serious problem, and I was just wondering how big it might be. On the way to work today, I was listening to the radio, and in a period of 20 minutes, I heard three new scientific studies, all health-related, that seemed to offer breakthroughs in three different areas. I suppose a lesson from what you've been telling us is we should perhaps be a little more skeptical about that sort of thing.
You know, I think that's definitely one of the takeaways that I learned from researching the decline effect. And I think one of the ironies, especially here in America, is that the public tends to be skeptical of the exact wrong kinds of science. We're skeptical of things like, you know, evolution by natural selection and climate change. These are scientific ideas which have enormous empirical support, which have been documented in thousands and thousands of different ways. These are claims we should not be skeptical of, and yet in most polls, the majority of Americans are skeptical of both of those ideas. Instead, I think we should be more skeptical of a lot of these newfangled, surprising medical claims, especially when they haven't been replicated a number of times, as Ioannidis has shown, and as he's argued, I think, convincingly in a number of prominent journal articles. There's good reason to believe that a majority of medical findings are false. So we should certainly be skeptical of these claims, and at the very least insist that they be done as rigorously as possible. And I think before we change medical practice, insist on several replications, because I think the history of a lot of this literature is the history of people changing their minds, of results that look great at first and then slowly fall apart over time.
Jonah, this is obviously very important. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jonah Lehrer is an American author and writer. We've been talking about his article in The New Yorker in December called The Truth Wears Off. He's also the author of two books, How We Decide and Proust Was a Neuroscientist.